to inform all parties that this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Okay, so this is the September Charm Telecon, and we're lucky to be joined by Dr. Mark Showalter. And Mark is from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, and he's one of the Cassini ring scientists on the mission. And he also works on New Horizons. I was just reading his bio on the SETI website and found that some of his earlier work on Voyager led to the discoveries of Jupiter's Gossamer Ring and Saturn's moon Pan, and I'm aware of a lot of other science that he's contributed to as well. For this telecon, he's going to talk about the recent equinox at Saturn and equinoxes in general and what we learn. And with that, I welcome Mark.
Great. Thanks, Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I took maybe a little bit of a risk when I offered to give this talk as early as September, given that Saturn's equinox was just about a month and a half ago. My plan had been that if all else fails, I could certainly talk about the long and interesting history of equinoxes at Saturn without a specific focus on Cassini. Turns out a couple of teams have been very busy, specifically ISS and SEERS, and there was a whole slew of new releases and information coming out just a week ago, which made my talk particularly timely, as it turns out. So I will spend about the first half of the talk going through kind of some of the history of equinoxes and why they're interesting, particularly to ring scientists. And after that, I will move into a very raw and unfiltered interpretation of my initial reactions to some of the results coming out of the imaging team and the Cassini infrared radiometer team. So with that, we will begin. My first slide was somewhat intentionally chosen not to be a Cassini image, in part because there really wasn't anything about equinox from Cassini yet, and but also just to realize that Earth-based observing of the Saturn system and its seasonal changes goes back a very long time. These happen to be a sequence of images from the Hubble Space Telescope, a group led by Dick French, who was also on the Cassini radio team, showing the rings closing up as seen from Earth over the years. And, of course, at lower left, there really ought to be one more frame, except the wide-field planetary camera never took it, which was the rings, at least in this form, I should say, with the rings exactly edge-on. But equinoxes are kind of a mundane topic for us Earth-based humans. We had an equinox just about a week ago, and I suspect most of us barely even noticed. But they're a really critical component of our understanding of planetary rings. So moving on to slide two, I decided to go all the way back. We are, after all, celebrating the International Year of Astronomy. It's been 400 years since Galileo first pointed his 37-millimeter refracting telescope at the skies, discovered the moons of Jupiter, discovered quite a few other things, the mountains on our moon, the Earth's moon. It wasn't until 1610 that he actually finally took a look at Saturn for the first time, and this is a page from his notebooks. And you can see right there in the middle a little picture of three circles. That was his best rendering at the time of what he was seeing at Saturn when he looked at the planet Saturn. Page three is a little bit of a close-up of that now. This, of course, goes way back to the time before it was trademarked by the Walt Disney Corporation. You can see Saturn and some bright things off to the sides, which were his best interpretation of something that he did not quite understand. He had seen moons of Jupiter by then. He knew little dots moving around bigger dots, but these seemed to stay fixed in the sky, and that was quite mysterious at the time. 2 years later, on slide four, He published it 13 years later, but he actually made these drawings in 1616. And at upper left, you can see Saturn in a different form. He I don't think he ever actually quite understood what it was he was seeing, but you can see some bright things off to the sides that seem to now be an oval surrounding the planet Saturn. So let's jump ahead now on slide five to actually 350 years ago now this year. Christian Huygens, who, of course, the Titan probe was named after, published his book Systema Saturnium, and in that he finally, based on 50 years of data, figured out what really was going on with the Saturn system. And there you can see on page 47 of his book a drawing of the Saturn system with the rings around it. And this was, of course, then the moment that a planetary ring system first entered the human imagination. Let me take a little rip out of that book and zoom in on it a little bit closer on page 6. You can see in italics a quote that is very significant. He had actually published it earlier as an anagram, and you can see above it the anagram AAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAA something in a way that would let them claim credit for it if anybody else got there before they felt they were ready to really make the announcement. But by 1659, he was ready to translate his anagram as Anulo Singitur, and I don't pronounce Italian, so I'm not really going to try to pronounce that. There's surely somebody listening who could do a better job. But let's go through word by word. Anulo means ring, so the ring, Singitur, encircles, is thin, plano is planar, nuscam coherente, perhaps, nowhere connected, and finally, ad eclipticam inclinato, is inclined to the ecliptic. So, 350 years ago, we suddenly have the concept, at last, of a planetary ring. When I've talked about this in a number of talks over the months and years, but I had never quite sunk in until I prepared this talk, I'm ashamed to admit, why it was so important, he felt, to include this last couple of words, ad eclipticam inclinato, inclined to the ecliptic. What was it so special about that that it seemed to be right up there as one of the most salient features of the rings of Saturn? Should have been obvious, but, well, you learn something new every day. As I was preparing this talk, it sort of dawned on me. So let's go to page 7, where this is another page from Systema Saturnium, which Christian Huygens had assembled a number of drawings over the years of how the rings of Saturn looked. Among other things, they are a testament to the changing optical characteristics of the telescopes of the day. Certainly, I think figure 12 on the lower right is kind of amusing and fanciful, as well as 11 for that matter. But nevertheless, they are also showing, over 50 years, seasonal variations in the rings. The rings are sometimes open to Earth and sometimes closed to Earth. And finally, if you look at my slide 8, which happens to be page 55 out of Systema Saturnium, you will see what was such a big deal about the rings being inclined to the ecliptic. That was Huygens figuring out why there was so much variation over the years in how the rings appeared. And here he is essentially showing a view from a sun-centered view with the Earth moving around the sun, letter E, and then seasonal changes of Saturn, and on the outside you can actually see why sometimes the rings are big arcs, big ovals on the sky, and sometimes they essentially disappear. For example, at upper right, labeled D, would be a view in which the rings are essentially invisible, and at Saturn at that time, as far as they knew, looked more or less exactly the same as Jupiter did, just a little bit smaller. So our understanding of Saturn is very, very tied in to the history of the equinoxes going back at least 4 centuries. All right, now I'm going to jump ahead to the present day, and this is the first movie, so if you see that URL on page 9, please click on it or link to it. Maybe you might have downloaded it in advance, which is good. I'll wait just a moment before I show it. Now, this is from a couple of years ago, a Cassini movie. Probably you have seen it before. But, okay, I'm going to click on play right about now. And what you see is a view from Cassini. I just love this movie. It really gives you a sense of being there. But the key point is that there's nothing special at all about the rings at this moment, but Cassini is, of course, now passing through the ring plane. Depending on your timing, you may see a sort of inclined Mimas that comes in from the left toward the right. And when we get to the dark side of the rings, you see a couple little satellites that are closer into the rings that are harder to see except now that they're passing by. And finally, you also may notice that there's been a huge contrast reversal, whereas the B ring, that really bright one, at the beginning of the movie becomes black, and the Cassini division, which is dark, becomes light. That has to do with how much material is in the rings, the optical depth. If the ring is densely packed, then it's bright on the lit side and dark on the unlit side. If a ring is kind of diffusely filled with material, then it can actually get brighter as it scatters light through the rings. So that movie is the equivalent of an Earth-based equinox, but seen from Cassini. We have observed such things from Earth with the rings essentially disappearing every 15 years or so when we see them exactly edge on. And so in slide 10, what I did is take a slice out of that movie, the frame that is darkest, and show you what the rings actually look like for a moment in the movie you just saw. So the key feature is that the rings essentially disappear when they are seen edge on. This is certainly surprising to people going back centuries. We now know that the thickness of the rings is of order 5 to 10 meters. Now, that cannot be inferred from this particular image, but certainly some of the occultation data going back to the Voyager days and coming out of the UVIS team now, by basically looking at the rings at various angles and seeing how sharp the edges are, we can basically put that limit at of order 5 to 10 meters. That happens also to make a little bit of theoretical sense, because 5 to 10 meters is about the size of the biggest particles in the ring, aside from a few scattered exceptions. And what we're basically seeing is that the biggest particles scatter those around them until the entire ring stays about 5 meters thick. Collisions are acting continuously to dampen the ring down and bring it to as thin a configuration as it can possibly be. And the balance turns out to be approximately the 5 to 10 meters. Just an interesting statistic, if you go to the Book of World Records, the world record for pole vaulting is a little over 6 meters. So I think it's kind of amusing to think of the rings of Saturn as something that a human being can actually, or at least a few human beings, have actually been able to pole vault over. But, of course, in the other dimension, it's enormous. Page 11, you can see Saturn now to scale with the Earth and the Moon at left and right, also to scale. And there we have the rings of Saturn basically filling the distance from here to the Moon almost, yet nevertheless of a height such that it's probably shorter than whatever building you're sitting in when you're listening to my talk right now. Amazing proportions. So, page 12, now just a little bit of a summary. Why do equinoxes matter? I specifically mean for ring scientists in this case. We get to see phenomena that are normally lost in the glare of the main rings. The rings essentially disappear. Ironically, the ring system of Saturn is most interesting to look at when the rings are not visible. But when the rings disappear, we get to see the small satellites and the faint rings that are nearby. We also get to examine the vertical structure. The rings don't quite disappear. And so measurements of vertical thickness and warps and bending waves actually historically go back to equinox observations from the Earth. Also, we get to see satellite shadows, occultations, mutual events, those things that happen that have given us our best information about the precise orbits of the satellites in the Saturn system. So I had a bit of fun in this talk going back and just pulling up some of the historical documents that go back to previous equinoxes. And one of the major results coming out of the 1966 equinox was this article shown now on page 13 by Feidelman, who discovered, although the title says the D-ring, he was actually discovering the E-ring of Saturn, a very faint outer ring. You can see it in the diagram labeled figure 2 at the right there, where he took some densitometric measurements of a photograph taken. This was back in the days, of course, way before digital photography. But he noticed that it got a bit brighter off to the left of the planet, which was behind an occulting mask at this time, and inferred that what he was seeing was an edge-on ring. Now, a very faint ring will actually get brighter at equinox because at that time you're looking through a longer path length through the ring, and you can actually get, by piling up the material along the line of sight, it gets a little bit brighter. It's an amusing article citing Alexander, which is a wonderful, very old book about the Saturn system, and comparing the so-called D-ring here to the Loch Ness Monster. I recommend that you maybe go back at your leisure and take a look at this article. It's quite entertaining. Page 14, also from the 1966 Equinox, we had the announcement of the discovery of a satellite by Dollfuss. He found something that at the time got to be known as Janus. There's been some confusion about that over the years. As we know now, Janus and Epimetheus are co-orbital satellites. They share the same orbit. And when we got back to that data in the context of finally understanding what was going on, it turned out that a few of his detections of Janus were actually detections of Epimetheus instead. And that caused a great deal of confusion, so that the orbit was very, very confusing and poorly determined at the time of its discovery around 66 into the early into the 70s. But that, of course, makes a lot more sense nowadays. So let's jump ahead approximately 15 years, approximately half a Saturn orbit, to the next equinox. Page 15, 1979, with quite a slew of announcements about the Saturn system, including this paper by lead author Larson. Among his co-authors is B.A. Smith. Brad Smith was, of course, the imaging team leader for Voyager. And you can see here one of the pages which shows a diagram, and now the E-ring is very, very clear off to the left in this particular picture. And there's also a little dot sort of about 7, 8 o'clock on the diagram, which they identify as a new satellite. It was in 1979 that we finally made sense out of the Janus-Epimetheus system. Epimetheus got its name, and then the small co-orbitals Helene, Telesto, and Calypso in the system were all discovered. Now, because 1979 was on the brink of Voyager's arrival, that was 1980, people tend to forget that these were actually Earth-based discoveries, but they were. And Voyager followed up and did much better observations and found, of course, a few more satellites, such as Pandora and Prometheus and Atlas, but these were actually Earth-based discoveries. One of the other very interesting results from 1979 was at upper right a plot that Steve Larson was almost, actually I don't think he published it in the 70s, he was, or even in the early 80s, he was a little bit too embarrassed, but he measured the color of the E-ring and found it to be blue, and blue is just not the color you expect essentially any object, except maybe Earth, because it's got liquid water on the surface, to be in the solar system. Essentially every object is red. And he was puzzled by this, and I guess in his heart of hearts he didn't quite believe it. But as I started working with him a little bit later into the late 80s, we started to think maybe this is interesting, and it became one of the fundamental and true facts about the E-ring that it is blue. At lower right, I show an image with hyper-enhanced color. This is a Hubble image taken by Phil Nicholson and myself and some colleagues in the 1995 ring plane crossing, showing the E-ring now quite clearly and also very, very distinctly blue. So that result held up, but it goes back to the 79. All right. This is now a 1979 result. Is not also well publicized until much later, but when you look at the data on the E-ring as shown at lower left, there's a very distinct peak in brightness, which almost perfectly coincides with the orbit of Enceladus. So I get to cite my own paper for once. This is from the abstract of a paper I wrote in 1991. Hence, we can give some credence to the possibility that the E-ring originates in geyser-like eruptions from the surface of Enceladus. A lot of people sort of forgot about that, but, of course, as we all know, and I reproduce on page 18 now, one of the truly great results from the Cassini mission, and just an extraordinary image, and obviously it's been followed up quite a bit since then, but here we are, November of 2005, Cassini flies sort of behind onto the dark side of Enceladus, looks back toward the sun, and here are these enormous plumes coming off of the southern hemisphere. Wonderful, wonderful picture. I just have to tell you, though, that for at least a number of us in the rings community, it was great to see that image, but part of our reaction was, oh, well, tell us something we didn't already know. Not that we knew what the geysers would look like or anything, or that they'd be anywhere near that dramatic and beautiful. But the idea that material is coming off of Enceladus and spreading out to form the E-ring goes back quite a long time earlier than November 2005. In fact, if you look at this image, and maybe it's not always been noted, but the dark side of Enceladus is black, okay, not surprisingly. The region of sky surrounding Enceladus is not black. It's a sort of a neutral gray, a dark gray. But the reason for that is you are actually looking at the E-ring everywhere in this image. The plumes are, of course, E-ring material, densely concentrated and so quite a bit brighter. But the reason, essentially, the Enceladus is dark because there is no E-ring there, whereas everywhere else there is E-ring. So that's how the dark side of Enceladus is actually darker than the sky. Okay, those are essentially all results from 1979, although I jumped around a little bit. 1995, the next equinox, we had the Hubble telescope. Orbiting at that time, the Wide Field Planetary Camera 2 was a very, very capable instrument, only recently retired. And Phil Nicholson led a group of us doing quite a bit of observing. I showed the E-ring image a little earlier. But we got a lot of interesting results. For example, here we have the images taken during the ring plane crossing period. This is Earth's passage through the ring plane, which was in August of 95. And you can see some changes in brightness as we go from the dark side to the lit side, and things start to get brighter. But you also notice a distinct asymmetry just in this curious color enhancement where pink or magenta is actually brighter than blue, but not as bright as white. So you can see in the middle panel that the right side of the rings is distinctly brighter than the left. That has been ascribed to some warpage of the ring plane, has to do with the gravitational influence of Titan, which tends to distort what's called the Laplace plane, so that the equatorial plane, the plane where everything settles to in the system, the Laplace plane, is not exactly coincident with the equatorial plane of Saturn, and therefore this little bit of twist means that on the right we had just a little bit more sunlight glinting back at us from the rings than on the left side. So a nice illustration of something that had been suspected earlier. We also got some interesting results in November of 1995. That's now on page 20. This picture actually showed up in a slightly different form on the cover of Science magazine. Here we have a very interesting geometry where the sun is shining exactly on the ring plane. This is November of 95. Earth happens to be a little bit off the ring plane. We're about 2 degrees off. So we get to see the dark side of the rings just as the sun is appearing onto the south side of the rings. Earth was on the south side of the rings already. And you can see some very interesting and unexpected contrast. For example, the very tip of the rings is very bright. That's actually the F-ring. And the F-ring, as it turns out, all these years, had been the dominant feature that everyone was seeing whenever they saw the rings edge on. We just never knew it because up until the Pioneer flyby toward the end of the 70s, we didn't even know there was an F-ring. Also, you see quite substantial brightness enhancement in the Cassini division in the middle. And the C-ring gets very bright, something that we didn't quite expect, but there were even some evidence of little arc-like features in the C-ring. Okay, page 21, sort of a not quite as exciting picture. It's a chart instead showing motions of various bright objects just outside the rings. Two of them were Pandora and Prometheus, and three others happen to be other features that we've subsequently identified were probably just clumps in the F-ring, because going back to the Voyager flybys in 1881, we knew that there were lots of weird clumps and other kinds of strange activity going on in the F-ring. A couple of things interesting here, though. One is that Prometheus was in the wrong place. Prometheus, from the Voyager days, extrapolated forward, was off its orbit by about 20 degrees. I think 19 is the actual number. It was way outside the error bars, so something was clearly going on to perturb the motion of Prometheus that we had not anticipated at all at the time of the flyby. Turns out now, based on work that was done by Nicole Borderies and Peter Goldreich and some others, that there is an actual chaotic interaction between Prometheus and Pandora. One of the first really concrete examples of chaotic, dramatic illustrations, I should say, of chaotic interactions in the solar system, having to do with a very obscure resonance, 137 to 140 or something. I'm sorry, I don't have that written down, but you can go to the journals and find it. A very weak resonance, but it happens to couple together Prometheus and Pandora so that one speeds up and the other slows down, and they do this kind of interactive dance over a period of years. Completely unexpected. We'd also note that Pandora was really in the wrong place. We just didn't know it at the time, and it turns out that we should have had models for Pandora's motion that included perturbations from Mimas. If we had that, then Pandora would also have been off by about 20 degrees in its predicted ephemeris. So we learned a whole lot about the dynamics of the F-ring system and its nearby satellites, Pandora and Prometheus, in 1995. So page 22 is a summary. Perhaps if you hadn't heard everything I just said, you might notice there's this very strange pattern that major discoveries about the Saturn system seem to come at roughly 15-year intervals, but of course, the reason actually is that those are the times of the equinoxes, the times when we get to see aspects of the system that are otherwise invisible. So that brings us, of course, now to 2009 and the current equinox. I don't have a list of prominent Earth-based results for 2009. Maybe that's in part because the equinox is so recent, but the bottom line is that the recent events were not observable from Earth for reasons that I'll get into in a moment. So this was really Cassini's opportunity to have us to see the system at a time when Earth, unfortunately, we Earth-based astronomers could not be looking. Let me just show you a slightly different topic, but related, slide 23, some infrared images from the Keck telescope by Imke de Potter and others, showing the Uranus system over the years, Uranus, another ring planet, of course. And we had an equinox of Uranus in 2007. That's a much rarer event. Uranus takes 84 years to circle the sun, so we only get an equinox every 42 years. This was the first and only since the rings of Uranus were even known to exist, and, of course, we have a very long wait now till the next one. But there's some interesting things going on here. For example, if you look at the 2007 view, you see the brightest place is kind of halfway down the ring system. It's not at the tip the way that it is in 2006. That's actually a very interesting result because it's showing the Zeta ring, a ring that had not been seen since the Voyager flybys, and is no longer in the same place as it was in the Voyager flybys. So we seem to see evidence that a very faint ring, only visible from Earth in 2007, had shifted by a couple of thousand kilometers in the intervening years since the Voyager flyby of 1986. So this joins the category, seems to be growing, of rings that have actually changed significantly over time scales of order decades. But it's a very nice result that Imke de Potter obtained. Okay, so let me now show you some charts of just what was going on. 1995 was a really great year. This is slide 24 now, where you can see, now just imagine to understand this diagram, you're sitting on Saturn looking up at the sky. You're looking along the ring plane, which is that horizontal line marked zero. And the equinox happens when the sun here crosses from the north side to the south side, which is identified as roughly November 17th to 21st of 1995. The sun, being a finite disk, is actually taking 3 days here to cross the ring plane. So there's a period of time when the sun is actually shining on both sides of the rings by a little bit. But you can also see in the big sinusoidal curve, that's the motion of the Earth. And those gray regions happen to be the moments when the Earth and the sun are on opposite sides of the rings. So we get a very rare opportunity to see the unlit side of the rings from Earth. So this was an opportunity. We had three great periods of observing in May, in August, and in November. It was only the February event, the last time that Earth crossed from the north to the south side of the rings, that happened pretty close to solar conjunction and there were no observations. But we got to see two edge-on opportunities of the rings in May and August, and then a sunlit edge-on opportunity with the Earth 2 degrees off in November. Really, really extraordinary observing. Now let's compare that to 2009, and you see that we have a little bit of a problem with the Sun and the Earth crossing at almost exactly the same time. Let's zoom in on that now. I'm going to draw a little box, which is just slide 26, and zoom in on slide number 27 and provide you some more of the details. So the equinox was on August 11th. That's when Cassini got some of its most dramatic images and thermal results. The Earth crossed the ring plane roughly the same time, just September 4th. But the key kicker is conjunction, when the superior conjunction, the Sun being between us and Saturn, was on September 17th. Just a few days, well, a week and a half ago. So you can't look at Saturn when the Sun's in the way. Just basic rule of astronomy, astronomy 101. So we only had one crossing of the ring plane. It happened almost exactly when the Sun was in conjunction with Saturn. And so this was unobservable from Earth. And this is the reason there was no Earth-based data coming at this equinox. And in fact, bad news for those of you looking forward saying, oh, well, at least maybe 15 years ago we'll get another shot at it. The geometry of the Earth, ring plane crossing, the equinox coming up in roughly 2024, is that, is almost the same as this one. It's going to be terrible for Earth-based observing. It's not till Saturnian year from now, which would be about 2038, that we get another really, really good Earth-based observing opportunity. So, you know, make your plans now, I guess. We have a few images and things that just showed you the best we got. On page 28 now, SOHO, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, was able to observe by basically occulting the Sun, and here we have an image as close as we can get to the solar conjunction, and that little dot with the arrow on it, that is Saturn. This image is also available at the Cassini website, but this is an illustration of why there was no Earth-based data this time. Also, of course, solar conjunction of Saturn is a pretty bad time for Cassini as well, because our communications link has a lot of interference and we can't get very much data at this time. Luckily, most of the equinox events happened a little bit earlier, and it didn't affect our downlink quite as much. But we're in a bit of a lull right now in Cassini activities because of limitations of communication. Page 29, we show one of the actual last images taken by the wide-field planetary camera on Hubble. It goes back to February now, which was the opposition of Saturn, the best time to view it. And here you can see Titan as a body casting a shadow on the ring, on the planet. This is just another illustration of one of the things that happens around equinoxes. The rest of the Saturnian year, you do not ever get shadows of the more distant satellites on the disk of the planet, but here is one of them. So that's pretty much it. That's the slim pickings we got from Earth-based data in this year. But so now I'm going to start moving on to Cassini, where luckily it had the front row seat to see things that we Earth-based observers unfortunately missed. Page 30 does have a movie. If you want to click on it, you can. It's not absolutely critical. But I want to illustrate here one of the interesting seasonal phenomena of the Saturn system. These are the so-called spokes. Detected very prominently in Voyager images from 1980 and 81. That was shortly after the last equinox, I'll remind you, that the equinox had been in 79. The rings were only open to the Sun by 4 and 8 degrees, respectively, during the Voyager flybys. And you can see very, very prominent spoke activity, these dark sort of wedge-shaped, mostly, or linear features, mostly in the B ring there. And if you managed to look at the movie, you just saw an animation of the a sequence of Voyager images in which very prominent spokes are going by. Well, Cassini gets there. It's around 2004. And everybody starts to say, where are the spokes? The spokes were not showing up at all. They had been seen by Hubble in the intervening years, by the way. But Cassini did not see a single spoke at first. There was a lot of speculation about this, but a certain group of people, of which I admit I was not a part, said, oh, don't worry about it. It's just the lighting geometry. And as soon as the Sun starts to get closer to the ring plane, spokes will start showing up again. They're really there. We just can't see them. I happen to be a skeptic, but it's one case where I've been happy to be proven wrong. Cassini's first spoke image was published by the imaging team in 2005, September. It's shown here, slide 31. By the way, depending on your viewing geometry, sometimes spokes are light and sometimes spokes are dark across the B-ring. It depends on the phase angle as to whether we believe these spokes are made up of fine dust in front of the rings or in the rings, and those dust particles get brighter at high phase angles in forward scattered light, whereas they're darker in backscattered light. So here, these bright striations are actually the first spokes. Not super impressive compared to that movie if you just downloaded it. But there's a spoke. A spoke is a spoke, and at least we saw one at that time. Now I'll move a couple of years later. It's November of last year, and spokes are starting to become quite more common. This image, page 32, is looking a lot more similar to what Voyager saw. Slide 33, now these spokes are essentially everywhere. This was February of this year. And so the people who said it all just had to do with lighting geometry were absolutely right. That seems to be all that's going on, and spoke activity is every bit the same as it was in the Voyager data. It's just that we can only see it now. Let me illustrate that with a little bit of a cartoon I came up with, page 34. So the idea here is that suppose it's summertime on Saturn, and the sun is shining down on the rings from a fairly high angle. Now, I've drawn in blue a fairly dense ring. That's say that's the B ring, per se, perhaps. And in yellow, some smattering, diffuse little collection of smaller particles hovering above the ring plane for whatever reason. Honestly, we don't know the physics of spokes very well. But let's just say that's what's going on. Well, in this particular view, with the sun shining down, we all know the ring is very bright. The B-ring is a very, very bright ring. It's very densely packed. It's made up of water ice. It's just practically white. Those little dust particles, there aren't very many of them. They don't have much cross-sectional area, and besides which, your path goes sort of directly vertically, almost, down through them. So it's not a very long path through the dust particles before you hit the very, very bright B-ring. So for this reason, you can imagine that a diffuse cloud of dust above the B-ring seen at the peak of summer would be essentially invisible. Now let's compare that in picture 35 with grazing lighting, as was, say, February of this year for that picture I just showed you now. We're just lighting the rings from the edge. Now a couple of things are going on. First of all, that sunlight that's hitting the B-ring, it's still, of course, hitting the B-ring, but it's way spread out now. It's a 1 over sine factor. That same reason why when it's closer to the winter solstice for us, the sun's lower in the sky, we don't get as much sunlight, it gets colder. Well, the same thing is going on here. So the B-ring is not as bright in this lighting geometry, and meanwhile, your path goes through a lot more spoke particles in yellow before it gets to the B-ring. So the spokes become more prominent. So that's a simple hand-waving explanation of exactly what we're seeing, and it's the exact reason why the spokes that were so invisible early in the Cassini mission are now so prominent. And that actually leads me to one of the particularly interesting results that came out of the imaging team in slide 36. They found a couple of bright streaks atop the rings. At left, we have a streak in the A-ring, quite a long one. It's about 5,000 kilometers, I believe. The one on the right is in the B-ring. It's a little bit smaller, only something like 200 kilometers long. But these kinds of features were generally not seen any other time. These were taken on August 11th and 13th, respectively, which is right at the ring plane crossing, in effect. The midpoint of the sun crossed the ring plane at the beginning of August 11th. So it seems that there's something special about that lighting geometry that these streaks, which were probably there all along, are suddenly starting to show up. Now, the imaging team has inferred that these are probably the results of impacts into the ring system, perhaps meter-sized objects, meteoroids coming in from well outside the system, hit the rings, are blown to smithereens, form a plasma and a lot of fine dust, and that dust then spreads out, and just for the same reason the spokes become visible in this lighting geometry, well, these pulverized impactors also become visible as bright streaks. That makes sense up to a point, and let me now just sort of interject my own interpretation. Raises a couple of questions, too, because one of the things you can infer based on the length of these streaks is how recently they happened, and the imaging team estimates 1 to 3 days ago. So, I mean, that's perfectly plausible that meter-sized objects should be hitting a surface area of the size of Saturn's rings on such a regular basis that you would see a couple of these things when they're only a day or two or three old. Trouble is that dust has actually been bouncing up and down through the ring plane quite a few times in that 1 to 3 days, and chances of any dust particle actually going through the ring multiple times, particularly in the B ring, and not hitting something and sticking to it are pretty small. So that says to me that, well, it's a little hard to understand why dust that appeared a couple of days ago is still there. Dust re-impacts particles and disappears out of the ring system very quickly. So that's at least one issue that probably needs to be worked out, ironed out, needs a little bit more work. I'm sure there are imaging team people who are working on it, and I won't say any more about it. The other one is another puzzle that comes out of the fact that if you look at the theories of spokes, of which we don't have a great success history, I should note, but nevertheless, most of those theories involve impacts into the ring. So you have a body, it hits hits the rings, it gets pulverized, and that material spreads out to form a spoke. That's essentially where every model of spoke formation begins. And yet here we have impact features, perhaps they're impact features, but there's no spoke anywhere in sight. So I look at this, and I got to ask the question that if this is really an impact into the rings, then maybe we should start looking into totally different explanations for the spoke phenomenon, or maybe this is a different phenomenon. But at least we've got some thinking to do about this based on this wonderful set of results coming from the imaging team.
A quick question on that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, which direction is the sunlight coming in those frames?
If you go, you see the PIA number, you can actually type that into a web browser and you'll go immediately to the Cassini site and get the full caption, which I believe does answer that question. I'm afraid that off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Okay.
This is during the exact period of sunlight crossing the, of sun on the ring, or crossing the rings. These are both lit side images, I can tell you that much. But as to whether it's coming from the right or left or whatever, I'm not so sure. I do recall that it said in the caption that these are not ideal lighting geometry for dust. They are, presumably that means it's not a high phase angle. This is not forward scattered viewing geometry. You're not looking back toward the sun. It's some other lighting angle. But you could find that out. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay.
Good. Moving on, slide 37. This was a picture going back to January now that they, the press people, I thought it was very cute, called a Groundhog Day. But the idea being that this was one of the first images of a shadow, a satellite casting a shadow on the rings. This, in this case, it was a shadow of Epimetheus. But if you think about it, as the sun gets down toward the ring plane, all these bodies have shadows, but most of the time the shadows miss the rings. And when you get down toward edge-on lighting, the shadows begin to hit the rings, and they become these long, drawn-out ellipses. So if you go through the press release archive or even just go through the online collection of raw data that's available, you see an awful lot of these pictures as we get closer and closer to equinox. I've just picked out a few more. The Epimetheus shadow, again, July 11th. The reason I want to show that is by contrast to what you saw in January on page 37. If you look at page 38, it's a very long streak. And it's also a kind of blurry streak, the reason being that Saturn is not a point source. You're seeing basically the difference between the umbra and the penumbra of the Epimetheus shadow here, making it a kind of a fuzzy shadow. Slide 38, we've got the shadow now of Tethys. It's a much more distant object, so its shadows don't hit the ring plane till much later. In this case, it was May. And, okay, I'm overdoing it perhaps, but then slide 40, a shadow of Pan. As was mentioned earlier, I actually was a discoverer of Pan in the old Voyager data, so I always am fascinated by any cool picture of Pan that I come across, and this one was put out by the imaging team in July and shows a very, very lengthy shadow of Pan crossing the A-ring. Pan orbits there in the Encke gap in the outer A-ring. Okay. Slide 41, what else happens with these shadow things? Well, this was a remarkable image. Actually made it into the blogosphere very quickly, and that's where most people saw about it. This is an image of the edge of the B-ring. The inner edge of the Cassini division, or the outer edge of the very bright B-ring, lit from the edge, now suddenly we see, I hate to call them mountains. That's not a really accurate description, because they're very, very short-lived mountains. They probably go up and down over periods of hours. But nevertheless, a very, very irregular series of bumps on the outer edge of the B-ring. Quite a beautiful and remarkable result. Let me talk a little bit about what's going on there. Unfortunately for me, probably for a lot of ring people, when we saw this image for the first time, it was like, oh, I wish I had thought of that, because this really shouldn't be too surprising that we're seeing this phenomenon, and the reason is a very simple one. Let's start now with walking through a sequence of images beginning on page 42. I have taken here two images out of the data archive showing the B-ring edge. These are part of a movie that was taken a couple of years ago. I'm sorry I could tell you the exact date, but I don't have it with me off the top of my head here. But these images were taken just a few hours apart. So what I'm going to do now, follow along, step 43, I color one of them red, and I color the other one a mixture of blue and green, which is called cyan, or sort of this turquoise color. And then I overlay them on slide 44. And what do we get? We get mostly cancellation. We get mostly gray, because those two colors added together make gray. And the features in the rings are mostly axisymmetric, so it doesn't really matter if pictures are taken a couple of hours apart. If they're showing the rings with the same geometry, then pretty much nothing changes and you see a neutral gray. Now, there's a pretty glaring exception in this case. There is a red stripe at the outer edge of the B-ring. That red stripe is caused by the fact that on the previous slide, the edge of the B-ring was in a different place in the red picture than in the cyan picture. We have actually understood that for quite a few years. It was Daniel Kirkwood, astronomer back in 1887, I think, who came up with this phenomenon of resonances and their effects on, throughout the solar system. He was most famous for the Kirkwood gaps, which are the gaps that Jupiter clears in the asteroid belt. But a few years after describing them, he turned his attention to Saturn and noted that the edge of the B-ring, or the inner edge of the Cassini division, more precisely, is almost exactly atop the 2-to-1 resonance with Mimas. That means that Mimas goes around the planet exactly once for every time a ring particle at the edge of the B-ring goes around twice. When you have this resonant kind of configuration, you get a very, very strong buildup of the little gravity impulses of Mimas. Normally they would average out, but at this resonant location they build up, and you get radial variation in the edge of the order of 140 kilometers, as shown. So it's been known about for a long time. Well, what does this mean? The B-ring is a fairly dense ring to begin with, and the edge is moving in and out by 140 kilometers. And it's not that hard to envision. Picture 45 is my little cartoon. So before, imagine you have a wall on two edges and a bunch of ring particles in between, and those walls are now 140 kilometers or so apart, a few hundred kilometers, and now you squeeze so that they're closer by 140 kilometers. What's going to happen? Well, seems pretty obvious to me, and everything, it should have been obvious in hindsight perhaps, that if you take a densely packed ring and squeeze it by 140 kilometers, the particles have nowhere to go but up. And if they go up, then presumably that explains why they make this highly irregular pattern on the edge of the B-ring, which I now show again just so you can follow along now on page 47. So presumably this is what happens when you take a bunch of ring particles and you squeeze them together. And if we followed this pattern for long, we would see the ring kind of flatten out perhaps at the other extreme where the ring edge is further out, and then every time it gets pushed in by Mimas, that these mountains form very temporarily because they've got nowhere else to go. Well, what does that imply for other rings? Well, now that we know it's there, we can expect it elsewhere. The most obvious place in our solar system is the Epsilon ring of Uranus, here shown on page 48 as a kind of a cartoon. The Epsilon ring has a surprising feature that it's very, very fat at one end and very skinny at the other. It varies from 20 kilometers wide to 100 kilometers wide. It's also eccentric, a little bit offset from the planet's center, its center is. But if all the same material gets to be 100 kilometers wide at one end and then has to squeeze through a 20-kilometer gap, set of walls, I should say, at the other end, you can be pretty sure that if we ever get a look at the Uranian ring system seen edge-on or lit edge-on, it's going to show this effect. It's going to be a big fat ring, vertically thick at the skinny end, and a lot flatter at the 100-kilometer end. So I get to make that prediction, and I'm very confident that it'll never be tested in my lifetime, because the next opportunity to see that is either if we send a spacecraft to Uranus, which isn't going to happen anytime soon as far as I see coming out of our nation's and as well as ESA's exploration plans. But furthermore, the next equinox isn't for 41 years or so. So we'll never see that, but It's nice to know it's there, and perhaps this even has some role in explaining this large eccentricity and this large 20 to 100 kilometer width variation in the ring, something that hasn't been considered perhaps in the past. Okay, more shadows on page 49. This is some wonderful images of Daphnis, the companion of Pan. It's at the next gap out, the Keeler gap in the A ring, and it's producing a wavy edge of its own. And that wavy edge, where it is most highly perturbed, which is right in the neighborhood of Daphnis, gets vertically extended. So here we have Daphnis casting its own shadow. We have the wavy edge that it generates is also squeezing the ring every wavelength down, or leading it and trailing it, depending on which side of the ring you're talking, which edge of the gap you're talking about. And so you can see the long shadows that are the result of the squeezing of the ring. Obviously, I'm hand-waving here. There's a lot more dynamics that can be done to understand what's really happening, but in a little bit of hand-waving, that's clearly what's going on. Here's a close-up, a more recent image from July, page 50, and in fact, I zoom in and do a little bit of contrast enhancement of my own on slide 51, and you can see just how far that shadow is moving. The few thousand kilometers between the edge of the A-ring and the Keeler gap, and you can see the shadow is every bit that long, and that, with a little bit of trigonometry, will tell us the height of that particular feature. I can't tell you what it is off the top of my head. Okay, 52 is an interesting picture that was published a few weeks ago showing something hitting or appearing to hit the F-ring. I'm not quite sure what this feature is. I think we do know that bodies hit the F-ring periodically and create bursts of dust, but it's hard for me to believe that's actually what we're seeing here, because those events don't happen all that often, and for the narrow-angle camera to be pointed at the F-ring at just the precise moment that one of these things was actually hitting the core seems unlikely. I haven't evaluated the probability, but I'm sure it's very, very low. So I don't actually know what this image means. It's probably not an impact per se into the F-ring. It's one of the, it's a clump of some sort near the F-ring casting a shadow across the F-ring, that's for sure. And I would suspect it's one of these moonlets, which I show from an earlier release to the public, page 53 here, showing a few little so-called moonlets near the F-ring. When these do hit, and we've seen a few impact events, or at least the aftermath, they create very large, very bright features in the ring. But meanwhile, they're just orbiting nearby, and most of the time they don't actually hit the core. I suspect the previous image I showed you was not an actual impact, but instead just a close passage, close enough to cast a shadow, and with the new viewing lighting geometry, it became more prominent. Okay, moving on to 54, just some of the other illustrations of vertical structure that we get to see now that we don't see any other time. There are a couple of ringlets in the Encke gap, which is this bigger gap in the middle of the picture, and you can see now that they have ringlets. Those ringlets are very bright, and those ringlets are casting shadows. So there's also some vertical corrugations. These ringlets have some dynamical relationship with Pan, presumably. The middle one actually orbits in the same orbit as Pan and seems to be tied to Pan in a number of dynamical ways. But the vertical structure had not been expected, and I'm not sure we understand the details of that yet. Page 55, the imaging team found some couple of these really very strange bumps in the ring. These are probably examples of the largest ring particles. This one is in the B ring, and they estimate it's about 400 meters based on the length of the shadow. The next one, page 56, shows a close-up of one in the A ring. What's interesting about this one is it's in a region where the imaging team found propellers, these so-called features that seem to be related to concentrations of mass or probably embedded larger bodies, a few hundred meters in size, in the A-ring, most prominent in a couple regions of the A-ring, but this one happens to be in the region where we see propellers, so it's actually probably one of the bodies that's actually producing propellers in the rings. Page 57, one of the features from the ring plane crossing that I find most interesting is this wavy structure that you can see here in the C-ring. It's a periodic pattern of bright and dark in this lighting geometry. It goes all the way across the image from left to right, as you can see it here. And even better, on page 58, you can see it in a little bit more detail, a mosaic the imaging team recently released, showing it going essentially all the way across the C-ring. And even if you note, there's a couple of gaps there, and the gaps don't seem to stop it, so that it's on the insides and outsides of gaps. Well, that feature has a little bit of a history, which I find quite interesting. I was actually involved in some of the early work led by Matt Hedman at Cornell. We were studying the D-ring, which is an innermost and very faint ring, and here on page 59, you can see a close-up of a wavy pattern that Matt noted, Matt Hedman, and when he first measured it in November 2004, it had a wavelength of approximately 34 kilometers. He measured it again in June of 2005, and got kind of sort of the same number. It was about 32 kilometers. Not a big enough difference to really say it's anything more than measurement error, but by August of 2006, it was 31 kilometers, and we were starting to get suspicious. It turns out that this is a vertical corrugation in the rings, and over the period of years, we are seeing it wind up. So let me explain a little bit about what that means. First, on page 60, I just wanted to illustrate from a different view of the D-ring published by Matt Hedman, and then a wireframe image that I produced some years ago. The idea being that if you're looking at a ring and it's kind of close to edge on, and it's just got vertical ripples, those ripples become bright and dark features that you can see sort of symmetric about the red line in the lower panel, which is just a little computer drawing. And then in the upper diagram, if you follow some of these features in the D-ring, you can see the same kind of phenomenon. Well, the idea here now is page 61, kind of a movie I'm going to flip through very quickly. You start off with a bunch of ring particles in orbit, and this is actually a cutaway view, so you can imagine, although I'm showing just little dots as if they were ring particles, these are actually cross-sections of entire rings. Well, suppose, now I'm just going to say suppose because I don't have an explanation, but something happened, and let's just say, spring of 1984, to be a little bit concrete, something happens that tilts the ring plane. So this is page 62. And then we let go. Nothing happens to the rings after that. They just follow their basic motion. So page 63 shows that if you tilt a ring and the planet in the middle in purple is a little bit oblate, it's a little bit flattened, you can see now I've drawn in some mirror particles at the other tilt, and the rings are going to wobble up and down between these two extremes because of the oblateness of the planet. So in page 64, now let's just note that not only do the ring particles or the rings themselves actually wobble, but they wobble at different speeds depending on how far you are away from the planet. So suppose we had, for example, some features that a ring that wobbles every 3 months at the closer to the planet and 6 months a little further from the planet. Now let's just follow this over a period of time. So we're starting, I've just picked the date, April of 1984, 0 months into this phenomenon, and you have a flat inclined ring. So wait 3 months, July of 1984, page 66. Some of the rings have actually gone up and down already because they only took 3 months, but some things have only gone up at the outer edge, and so that's taken 6 months. So you can see a kind of a warp to the ring. Now, wait another 3 months, and the six-month features have now returned, so you've still got a bendy ring, but now it's got a shorter wavelength. It's got a full bend in the picture that we can see. Then you just keep going, flip through the pictures at your leisure. After 9 months, you get another wiggle. After 12 months, you get another wiggle. And after 48 months, jumping ahead, you get another wiggle. And finally, on page 71, it's been 281 months since that moment in time, and you see a very, very wiggly ring. And that's why, page, I said, page 71. Well, that is what we're seeing in slide 72. That was not quite so hard to understand when the idea was that it was just a feature in the D-ring. Matt's idea, this is now slide 73, was that something hit the D-ring in, say, early 1984, and that tilted the ring on average, and then that warpage, that bending of the ring has been winding up ever since. The thing about this feature is that we can unwind it, and I didn't pick spring of 84 at random. Spring of 84 is what you come up with if you take the observable changes in the wavelengths that we're seeing over the years and simply unwind it. It unwinds to a particular date. Something happened at some date, which we don't know precisely, in 1984, caused this phenomenon to start, and it's just been propagating ever since. So the question now, which I think is very interesting now, summarized on page 74, we still know, based on the new results from the imaging team about the C-ring, that something happened in spring of 84. The pattern is still winding up, and if you run the process backwards, it unwinds to that moment in time. So the trouble is the something, which you notice I keep putting in quotes because I have no idea what it is, affected not just the D-ring, a small region, but 17,000 kilometers of ring, including almost the entire C-ring as well. So whatever happened was a very large event. Something tilted the ring, a large portion of the ring, in 84, and we're still seeing the ripple effects of that. Just remarkable, and I could speculate about what it is, but I don't think I want to because anything I guess would probably be wrong. So, moving on now, page 75, I just want to kind of wrap up now with the imaging results. Beautiful, spectacular image that they just put out. I suggest you go to the website and download the thing because this is just on small scale. It's an enormous mosaic. It's beautiful. It shows the rings lit exactly edge on. This is August 12th when the sun was still in the ring plane. Even though the rings are already very dark here, they've actually been brightened by a factor of 20 to 60 just so we could see them at all. Otherwise, they're essentially black in this viewing geometry because all that sunlight is spread out across the entire ring system, and most of the sunlight now is coming down. Most of what's illuminating the rings is basically reflected off Saturn, which is why it's bright on left and not so much on right. Page 76, you can see the one thing that is a little bit bright is the F ring, and that's consistent with some of the Hubble data we got back in 95 as well. But mostly you notice that it's just the right side of the rings is brighter because that's where Saturn shine is shining down on both sides of the rings. Well, that actually is a nice lead into the Cassini-Sears team, my own team, our results from the equinox. We've been watching the seasonal changes as the sun sinks down to the ring plane, and that's a movie on page 77. I suggest you click on the link, and if you have the option of, now I'm on page 77, if you have the option of fast-forwarding to about 1 minute and 14, I hope many of you can. The first part is a very nice animation about equinoxes and what they're all about, but if you've listened to my talk so far, you really don't need that refresher for the first minute and 14 seconds. But starting at about 1:14, we actually see the temperature history of the rings over the course of the Cassini mission. You can see some pointers, and you can start off, I'm going to click on the movie, and I'm going to jump ahead to roughly the minute point now. If those of you can't, I apologize, but just kind of bear with me. You'll see it when you see it. But what we see are starting with the rings in kind of the red and yellow zone let's see, I'm still waiting for the movie. I'm at 120 myself right now. Okay, so we take a picture of the rings. We color-code it by temperature, and you can see the color scale. So the rings are starting off at green. That puts them at the 80-90K level. You know, that's about the temperature of liquid nitrogen, for example. And then as the seasons, as we get toward equinox, which, of course, is when the planet gets warmer, our Earth gets warmer in the equatorial regions at equinox, but the rings are getting colder because that sunlight is spread out over greater and greater distance. Until finally, at the end of this movie, at the end of the sequence, we're now at about 40 degrees, which is incredibly cold. That's a very, very cold temperature, but that is basically now the temperature that we expect when the sunlight is essentially shut off. The only thing heating the rings at equinox is the sunlight scattered off or the thermal emission from Saturn itself. So for the same reason that the rings look kind of odd with just a little bit of extra sunlight on the sunward side of Saturn, for that very same reason, we're basically just seeing the effects of heat of Saturn when the sun is gone. Now, as a member of the Ceres team, I can tell you that the heating cycle of Saturn is a very, very complicated phenomenon, and it's kind of nice that this is a special moment where we can take away the sun as our primary heating source and really just see one of the two major sources of heat, this time being Saturn, all by itself. And I'm sure this is going to help us quite a lot in understanding the thermal history of the rings. Okay, 78. I just think it's very interesting to compare that beautiful Cassini image with our Hubble image. Now I've kind of squashed the Cassini image down to the same scale for comparison. These two images are very different. Even though the sunlight on the rings is almost exactly the same at the time of both these images, our viewing geometry is a little bit different, but I have to admit I'm very puzzled by the fact that the C ring, the B ring, so very bright in the Cassini image, is actually dark in the HST image, and some other things. The contrast is totally different. We need to understand that a little better. It may have to do with subtle aspects of exactly where the sun was at the time these two images were obtained. But it's just kind of a mystery that struck me as I was putting this talk together. So, page 79, I just want to wrap up this, the year of International Year of Astronomy. I guess I have to admit I first thought it was kind of just going to be a year of astronomy hype or something, but it's actually been very interesting for me to think back about where we've come, where Galileo was 400 years ago. So here we are. It's been 400 years of telescopic astronomy, 399 years since we've seen Saturn as anything more than a dot in the sky. That means that I guess we should start making our plans for another party next year. It's also 350 years since the publication of the Systema Saturnium and our understanding of rings as what they really are. Let's face it, this particular year, we're really in the heyday of the Cassini mission. We're just getting extraordinary results and building upon results from 5 years ago. So this is really about as good as it gets for planetary missions. I apologize if I just sound like a beer commercial. And then on top of that, we had the equinox, which didn't have to happen, didn't have to have any synchronization with any of these other events. So I'm going to finish with slide 80. You've seen it before. It goes back a couple of years, looking back toward the sun and the Earth, seen from the far side of Saturn and its rings. This is my version of the image. It's a little bit different from what you've seen before, only in the sense that I threw in the lens flare, which actually is visible in some of the Cassini images, and the press office opted not to use those particular images when it assembled this mosaic. I decided to put them back, in part because I think it makes the picture a little bit more real. This is not just the envisioning of some mad digital artist at Industrial Light and Magic. This is a real image, and with the lens flare in it, it reminds me that it's taken by a real camera that has real optics with real flaws in those optics, made by real human hands. And if Galileo could look at the rings 399 years ago through a 37 millimeter refracting telescope, it seems a little bit ungrateful of us to worry about a little bit of lens flare. So there it is. To me, makes it just kind of real. Now, page 81, you probably know this already, but there's a little dot in that picture, upper left. It's actually the planet Earth. And one of the things that strikes me about the International Year of Astronomy is noting the symmetry that comes from the fact that 400 years ago, Galileo points his telescope up and sees Saturn close up and personal for the first time. And here we are 400 years later with a telescope of our own looking back. So there you have it. Thank you very much for your time.
That was really a great talk, Mark. Very good.
Thank you.
Really great. So let's open it up for questions. I'm sure there must be questions on the line.
I blew you away, huh?
I have a question.
Okay.
Please. This is Alan up at the University of Maine. And when you were looking at the shadows of the moons across the ring plane,
yes,
did you attempt to derive any information about the moons or their structure, their shape as from the shadows?
So I certainly have not. That's a very interesting question. There are people who spend a lot of time trying to understand the shapes of these bodies, doing it mostly just by direct imaging. But you're absolutely right that these shadow images could be very, very useful in giving you some additional refinements about the shapes of these bodies. I could rattle off the name of a couple of scientists who will probably be working on that very question. I think I'll not do that. But it's a very good point and a very good question.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mark?
On the first page, this is Gordon Houston, Solar System Ambassador in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
On the first page, you show a credit of R.G. French. Who is that?
That is Dick French, Richard French, Professor of Astronomy at Wellesley, member of the radio science team on the Cassini mission. He was the one who led this. It was a team of astronomers. It includes Jeff Cuzzi, Jack Lissauer, Luke Dones is on the imaging team. Quite a few familiar names were all involved in this sequence of observations. This particular image was done by the Hubble Heritage people based on the WFPIC 2 images that they had obtained.
Okay. Well, thank you. A friend of mine, Rob French, works there at SETI.
Yes, he works for me, I should note, but a different R. French. Yes, good colleague, yes.
Yeah, okay.
More questions?
Hey, Mark, this is Sean Brooks at JPL.
Hey, Sean.
Quick question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you and Matt imagine will happen ultimately to the vertical corrugations in the C-ring? How is that going to ultimately wind up?
Well, what's the outcome? I'm glad you didn't ask me about the cause. I appreciate that. But the outcome is that it just keeps winding tighter and tighter. I mean, let's face it, in 1986, it's been going on for 23 years. So I got a feeling it's not going to go away anytime soon. But what eventually happens is you get to a limit where the wavelength is so short. I mean, let's face it, the wavelength can't be 10 meters. Nothing can have a wavelength of 10 meters in the rings because then you're basically at the scale of the individual particles. So basically you're going to get down to a point where collisions and other such phenomena are going to take over and it's all just going to average out and disappear. But all indications are that it's going to be around for a while if it's there 23 years, and particularly in the D-ring, the wavelength is still on the order of, it's well over 20 kilometers still. So to go from 20 kilometers down to the scale of order, kilometer or less, which is probably where collective effects would kind of eventually damp it out, we've got a long way to go yet. It's going to be around for a while.
It'll be interesting if we can to see it, to watch it kind of damp out. I don't think we'll have the resolution by the time it does, but it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, that may be a job for a future spacecraft at Saturn. Let's hope so, because I suspect it's going to be around for another good, certainly 100 years at least, based on the fact that it's still going strong after 23.
Any other questions for Mark? Do you want to speculate, Mark, on this event that you mentioned in 1984?
Okay, well, I can tell you, okay, I showed on, it was slide 73, this impact event, which could have been a small local effect if we were just talking about the D-ring. And by the way, this drawing, it's a photograph of a chalkboard drawing. I think my colleague Matt Hedman is actually the artist. It is uncredited here, and I apologize to the artists, but I think it's a wonderful illustration. The obvious first question you ask is, well, maybe it was just a way, way bigger impact. I did, and you know, let's face it, in the last 20 years or so, since whatever triggered this event, we have seen two, at least, impacts into Jupiter. There was the very recent one found by that amateur astronomer, and also Shoemaker-Levy 9, which, well, I called it an event, but it was actually dozens of events because the body broke up before hitting Jupiter. But we know that big-ish objects hit the planets regularly. It's just part of what's out in the solar system. If something were to skim across the rings as it fell into Saturn, maybe it could do some kind of disturbance that would hang around for a while and would have affected this full of order 17,000 kilometers of the ring. But I did a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, and it would have had to have been an enormous object. I mean, something that's just, I can't honestly believe that something that big fell into Saturn quite that recently. So I'm sort of less inclined to think it was something that flew past the rings. And then the question becomes, well, if it's something that hit the rings, why did it have such a broad effect? You know, here's an idea. I'm just going to throw this out there, and it's just off the top of my head right now, that suppose you had a Shoemaker-Levy 9-type event where something goes by Saturn and breaks up into a lot of little pieces and then goes off to on a distant orbit but eventually comes back, and then the second time it actually hits the inner part of the rings. So you have a lot of objects that are all sort of timed together because one object broke apart. And they're all coming back together in that sort of spring 1984 time frame, then you could have something that is really not just one body but a lot of littler bodies all hitting the rings at about the same time, and that could have a sort of widespread but simultaneous event or impact or effect on the rings. So don't quote me on that. That's just wild speculation. But
this is being recorded.
Yeah, okay. Well, then I can't be anonymous now, but
yeah.
Maybe that's an idea. I'm sure there are bright dynamicists out there that'll come up with a few other ideas too.
Yeah, it's intriguing though.
It really is. Yeah. It's a shame to think that only Voyager had gotten there a couple years later. We might have seen something quite extraordinary going on there right after it happened, and just imagine, and we'd know a whole lot more about it right now. But I guess 1984 was a time when nobody was really looking at Saturn very much. Certainly we didn't have the telescopes that were capable of the kinds of looks that would show you if something of this magnitude is going on.
Any other questions for Mark? This is kind of a big topic, but do you have any about the Cassini extended mission? Or do you have any particular big picture things that describe for us that you really think we should accomplish?
Well, you know, it's being called the, at least it's being nicknamed, and I don't know if that's, well, I guess we can own up to the nickname. It's as the Solstice mission, the hope being that we might be able to run for a full 7 more years, which will get us out to the summer solstice for the Northern Hemisphere. Seasonal change is the crux of what we're seeing here, and getting that seasonal change in, getting a full season of Saturn would be just remarkable. Being able to play back that Sears movie all the way to the end when the Northern Hemisphere is at its warmest, but the rings are also best lit and at their warmest as well, that would be quite extraordinary. Just the general fact that we're seeing in so many ring systems, and I didn't talk too much about the others, but there are definitely observable changes in the ring system of Neptune that go back to the flyby of 1989 versus what we're seeing in the present day. The idea now that rings are not static, they are features that change over time scales of decades. That's a really new result that's only come into our awareness recently. And so having a spacecraft that continues to operate at Saturn for what would then be on the order of a dozen years means we would actually be seeing in detail some of these phenomena that we're only just getting by random snapshots now and then and learning how ring systems change. We would get the full time history from Cassini of those changes.
Great. Okay, one last chance for questions. Okay, so hearing no other questions, I just want to say thanks for a really great talk. I mean, it was the graphics and just putting everything in the historical and big picture context. It was just a really great talk, so we really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
So I'll just mention for next month's Charm Telecon, we've got Bonnie Barati, and she just sent me an email. She's a BIM scientist, and her topic is going to be the search for activity on icy satellites that aren't Enceladus. So that sounds really interesting. So we'll hear from Bonnie next month. And again, thank you all for attending, and thank you, Mark. Talk to you next month.
Right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.